My name is Louise Moss. I am the Division Chair of STR, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this event where we're going to address how to measure the impact of research in strategic management. This event is the third in a series that we are running this year on the impact and relevance of strategic management. So do please keep an eye on the STR homepage or our social media for advertisements of the next events. I'm sure that we're going to have a very interesting conversation today, and thank you very much to the panelists for being here and participating, and also a special thanks to Florence Honoré for organizing this session. I'm going to hand over to Florence, and Florence is going to introduce the event and also the speakers for today.
Thank you, Louise. So good morning or good afternoon, everyone. So I'm delighted to co-organize and moderate this session on how to measure the impact of our research. So as researchers, we'd like to have a positive impact on firms and institutions. And how we realize if we have an impact is going to produce important consequences for our research in general, because it might make us reevaluate how we design impactful research and how we diffuse our insights. And of course, the context in which we evolve as researchers is also going to influence the impact we might seek. So we're welcoming four experts in this area to unpack these various aspects. Each of them is going to have 12 minutes to share their insights. And then we'll have time at the end of the session for questions and even maybe a bit of a debate we'll see among the panelists. So I'm going to introduce the four panelists in order in which they're going to intervene and then leave them the virtual floor. So we have Fernan Fry, who's an assistant professor in the Management and Industrial Relations Department of the Schindler College of Business. She studies the diffusions and impact of research insights during crisis and in developing countries. Then Leo Pongelupe, who's an assistant professor of management at the Wharton School of Management. Leo's primary research interests are related to stakeholder management and socioeconomic development in Brazil and in Africa, using methods to establish causal inference and to provide ethnographic background. We have Kostas Markides, who is the Robert P. Bowman Chair in Strategic Leadership at the London Business School. He did extensive research on innovations in firm. He wrote several impactful books on firms' innovation strategies, including how firms can change the rules of the game with new business models. And then we'll have Andrew Pettigrew, who's an emeritus professor at the Said Business School. His research promoted the use of contextualization in our field by taking a deep dive in various historical settings. Andrew is also concerned with the practical implications of our research in the evolutions of business schools, firms, and public institutions, studying and advising these. Okay, so now that we know who our four panelists are, I'm going to give the floor to Caroline first. Please, Caroline, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you for putting together this panel. It's really nice to talk about research and how we might be able to have a greater impact. So before we get to the idea of talking about impact, I thought it was worthwhile thinking through how we all define impact. And so obviously I asked ChatGPT how to define research impact, and it gave me many options. And so, you know, we could have academic impacts, impacts on government policy, health, environmental. And so I spent some time thinking, well, how do I define impact for my research and what are my goals? And so I'll come at it from that lens. So I really think that I would have had a positive impact if my research is able to improve scientific capacity that contributes to health, food security, climate resilience, and economic growth. That's my personal goal for the impact of my research. And how will I do that? What's the theory of change? Well, I suppose if the research can inform the development and modification of policies at several levels, including government, organizational, and international agreements. And I sort of hope to do that through sort of providing tools to policymakers, providing evidence to support investments in this area, and easing the formation of policies and evaluation of those policies. And so I try to do this through the three different facets of my job that I think I spend roughly equal times on. So first of all, I believe it would be difficult to do any of these activities without the actual research that I do. So that really comes first. So what I try to do is have a very clearly defined agenda that speaks to this desired impact. And in my case, I've tried to build this agenda around scientific capacity in emerging economies. So I try to ask questions that are really relevant for policymakers. And to do that, I have two basic strategies. So some projects I develop in collaboration with policymakers or decision makers, and others I use publicly available data, but I really have them informed by interviews with policymakers. So just one quick example of a project in which I really worked in collaboration with policymakers or an organization. So this paper now in organization science is the result of a multi-year project with the organization, the OST, which is the Organization for Women for Science for Developing Country. And I keep a running database of organizations operating in my space. Me, they're funders of science, training organizations, governments. So I managed to get a connection with this organization through a practitioner conference, actually, and just started asking them their problems. And of course, you know, they wanted to know what the impact of their program was. Initially, I was keen to run an experiment with them. This was hugely challenging, which I'm experiencing often with policymakers and governments, and running an experiment is a huge hurdle. But what I did manage to do is get hold of some of their data on applicants who were successful and unsuccessful into their fellowship. So I thought, okay, I can run an evaluation using a difference in differences method. And what it actually did was explore the heterogeneity of the impact of their fellowship program. And through doing that, was able to provide some insights into the mechanism and program design as opposed to running an experiment. And namely, in this project, we found that the fellowship only worked for women in high gender equality countries. Those in low gender equality countries actually had no effect. And so this has real policy implications that, you know, these women not only need to receive the fellowship support, but they also need to receive some institutional support, and the implications of that, which we are discussing with OAST. So that actually there was a Nature article covering this paper yesterday where the organization founders we're talking about the implications of these findings, is that they really do need to add some layer on some policies to support the women back at home in their countries. So they were talking about leadership programs and other training programs for their peers to support their how they're perceived as professionals in their workplace. So, you know, this was a little bit easier to have and measure impact, perhaps, because it was done in collaboration with this organization. But we tried intentionally to make sure that it was diffused and had some impact on decision making. So we wrote up a policy brief. That's something actually now I do with all my papers. So a two-page with a graphic posted on our website, shared with OAST and others. So we share it with future organizations when trying to collaborate as well, and present their findings. It hasn't, as far as I'm aware, turned into any actionable outputs yet, but perhaps even stimulating the conversation around this support was some sort of impact that's measurable I think worthwhile. And I've definitely put in my tenure packet that it's had lots of impact. So a project like that's a little bit easier to disseminate. But the second main way is to ask questions that are just important to populations that are interested in. So how do I find those? I talk to people on the ground. So this project was on a policy change that happened in Indonesia. And actually, it was my co-author went to Indonesia on his sabbatical and was asking researchers there about you know, what the challenges they had to their productivity was. And virtually every one of them mentioned this recent policy change that ranked every researcher in the country. So once we sort of identified that this was an important problem, you know, we found the data, did the evaluation, and then started to disseminate it, but it almost took a life of its own because it was so important to the population of interest. The academics really helped us with that dissemination. It got covered by quite a few outlets in Indonesia and globally. So we did make that concerted effort on Twitter, LinkedIn, and you know, we can capture some of those metrics. But it was picked up by the press because it was just a salient issue in Indonesia. There was a big debate about it, or about the merits of this policy. Okay, so that's the main way that I attempt to use my research to have a direct impact and somewhat measure it. But a big part of our job is teaching, and I try to use this also to achieve impact. So teaching EMBAs, executive MBAs, I also solicit research questions and perspectives from them. I try to work with as many PhD students as I can, especially those from emerging economies who would have direct impact. And that's some sort of impact that we can measure as well. And I also do a number of capacity building or training exercises with decision makers as a way to achieve impact and disseminate. So I have a few slide decks that I just use and offer these capacity building programs to organizations that I'm interested in working with. Okay. And the last part of my job where I'm really spending a lot more time now, and I feel very lucky that I can spend a lot of time, is this service idea. So I've been involved in the actual implementation of a lot of programs. And so this is sort of an easy way to translate not just my findings, but other research findings into action and measure how we can diffuse those findings. So I do it in both an advisory capacity, so with the government of Indonesia, we're now engaged in designing some of their programs. But actually, I'm getting involved in a lot of programs in my own community, and that's almost an easier place to start. So, for example, I'm co-directing this NSF Engines program here in Hawaii that's focused on building the innovation ecosystem in climate security technologies. And there I'm able to design all these programs that really are informed by research and design some that have an evaluation element embedded. So that's, I feel like, a very measurable way to evaluate my impact. Okay, and then some other ways. So how could I measure this? So, you know, I could measure my, and I do keep this running document because I'm untenured, so I need to. So I measure my own, you know, citations, the conferences I'm going to. In my research, I look at other people's research impact. So I look at their metrics on the Dimensions database or Altmetrics. You can look at citations in policy documents now, which is a nice measure of impact. So we could all get our own, actually. I look at it for low-income country scientists. I think an important metric nowadays is social media and news diffusion. You can capture those through, again, these databases. But I'm more and more sort of seeing the merit of these case studies and narratives describing ways in which we're stimulating these conversations with organizations and decision makers, and perhaps also engaging in program implementation and design ourselves. Okay, well, I'll stop there. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Caroline. I think it was a great source of inspiration for all of us. And definitely I'll copy the policy brief. I like that idea. Okay, so now, Leo, I believe it's your chance.
Yes. Do you hear me well? Yeah, perfect. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Florence and Lou. All right. Thank you so much, Florence and Luis, for having me in the panel. It's a great honor to be with you all, with Caroline, Andrew, and Costas. I'm looking forward to hear from you both. And I mean, I'm glad to share a little bit of my experience as well. So, I mean, putting the hat of economists, I would say, like the economist in me, if you're trying to how to measure the impact of strategic management research, I would say the economist in me would say, well, let's, you know, have a counterfactual, right? So Let's have a way to compare. But I don't think that necessarily editors will like the idea of let's randomly decide which papers get published and then we trace their impact in the community comparing to the ones that could have been published but did not, right? So I don't think editors will like, reviewers will not like, authors definitely will not like. So it's not that feasible, right? I'll give some like of the ways by which I try to approach this problem, because this was something that throughout my scholar career and the PhD and also as assistant prof is something that troubles me a lot, that takes my sleep away at night, especially coming from Brazil, moving abroad to pursue higher education, and now as a prof. Very often I lay down and say, like, what am I doing with my life, right? Like, I mean, I'm away from my family, from my friends, from my country. And the objective of all this is actually to try to pursue an impact, positive impact in society, right? And sometimes I know that we get with the burden of reviews and that is a long process as it should be for us to publish the most rigorous research possible. But sometimes you end up getting into this into this loop of reviews and R&Rs and service, and you don't see the light in the end of the tunnel in terms of like impact. So let me describe a little bit what I try to do, aiming to keep this light in the end of the tunnel and aiming to have a North Star. So I think similar to what Caroline described, I try in my work to focus on real world problems, right? So like big challenges that we have in our times. And to me, the North Star is really the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. So we have 17 different goals ranging from poverty alleviation, zero hunger, to climate change, to gender equality, and so on and so forth, right? So I think there is a set of goals that can help us guiding our research in terms of trying to build up a better world. I think the world is full of problems. We can all see whenever we are out and about. And as Caroline said, if we talk to people, we learn about them. So I think if we can use the theories, the toolkits that we have in our management profession, not only towards firm profitability, of course, I'm glad that we are focusing on that because it's an important topic as well, but to other teams, I think this is already a big step forward in helping to have a positive impact in the world, right? Like we have management capabilities that can be redeployed to solve some of these problems, and we need more research to help understand how management can be part of the solution and not part of the problem. So I think this is, for me, the first step. I think in terms of the second step, what I try to do in my research is, you know, often, especially, I think economists end up falling into this trap that they want to design the entire procedure, the entire intervention, and then measure a very very direct causal and effect, so it's well specified and so on and so forth. But they end up reinventing the wheel sometimes when they don't need, I think. So, and why I'm saying that? Because us as management scholars, I think we have the opportunity to really partner with organizations that are already doing great work on the ground. And we have nonprofit organizations addressing many of those big challenges of our times. We have for-profit organizations that are also attempting to challenge and tackle this problems. And even like the government in some ways as well, right? So we have people and organizations that have been dedicating their time and effort to address some of these challenges. And most of the time, these organizations don't know or they don't have clarity on how they go about of measuring their impact or measuring if they are actually achieving the goals that they want to tackle, right? And I think, again, us as management scholars, our theories, our toolkits, our methodologies, we can help them, we can empower those organizations to actually measure their impact better and discover if they are actually contributing or not, right? So I can give a couple of examples from my own research, just as for the sake of illustration. So we've together with Anita Magaha, my PhD supervisor, we partner with Natura, a Brazilian cosmetic company, that have supply chains in the Amazon region. And we basically help them, let's design a way to evaluate if the supply chain of Amazonian nuts and fruits is contributing to the conservation of the forest, right? So there is a deliverable for academia. We can have a paper out of it. We can have a case study out of it. But we can also have a report to the firm, right? We can have a practitioner report telling them, look, this is the impact that you are creating. This is how much it means in terms of carbon sequestration. This is how much it means to the populations in the area. Go forward or like redirect in this area, right? Another project is with an NGO in Rio that target training to favelas populations. So those are organizations called Banco da Providencia. They had this program going for more than 60 years, and they want to know if they had an impact in helping the favelas populations get to the job market, right? Either as the entrepreneurs or formal employees. So we set together, we designed an intervention aiming to test if the program was impactful or not. At the end of the day, it can result again in papers, in scientific contribution for the scholarly community. It can also result in a report for them, directing them to, well, you are having impact in these aspects or in these aspects. I'm very happy that, for instance, this research, this practitioner report end up influencing not only the direction of the NGO, but now the program has been scaled towards in the state of São Paulo. So it's not only achieving the local population of the NGO, but became public policy in the state of São Paulo. So again, second point, first, focus on real world problems. We have a gold mine in the world. We have so many problems to focus on. The second, partner with organizations that are already trying to tackle these problems and help them with our theories, with our toolkits to design ways to evaluate their impact. And the third, I think it's important to mention, is that we are all in, you know, PhD students, postdocs, assistant professors. We are in the system ingrained with this idea where we have to trace how much publications we get, how much citations we get, how much visibility we have in academia. And all of these are important for our tenure tracks, for our careers and so on. But to be honest, you know, the last thing that I want for my life is to have like a great citation score of research that basically has not helped to change anything in the world, right? So I would rather have like a positive effect on the lives of the ones that are suffering, of the environment that is getting depleted, than actually having more citations. So I think, you know, it's important to think on our careers in academia, but it's even more important to think above and beyond academia. You know, like, this is our job, but it doesn't need to constrain our possibilities or our passion. We need to think out of the box, and I'm pretty sure this is, you know, this is endogenous. It will also help the careers, but for sure it will have a positive impact on the life of the people that I think should be the ultimate goal of us that embrace the idea of becoming scholars. I think those are my 3 points. Just again, summarizing: work on real world problems, partner with organizations that are already working on the ground, talk to the people, as Caroline mentioned. And 3, of course, think on your metrics, think on your career, but think above and beyond to have a positive impact on society. Thank you.
Thank you, Leo. So here, I think we might get into almost a philosophical debate, which I think is great. So we'll see if the audience have questions or comments. As Louise brought in the chat, feel free to also start adding things in the chat. And now we'll go to Kostas.
Thank you, Florence. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for having me. What I thought I'll do, I don't have slides. What I thought I'll do is, instead of telling you what I think we should be measuring, what is the impact and how to measure it, instead of telling you that, I thought I'll give you the experience I had, or we had as a school here in London, with the research assessment exercise of the UK government, which is basically, for those of you not from the UK, just to give you the context, every 5 years, the UK government requires all universities and business schools to prepare a report telling them, you know, what research you've done and the impact this research has had on real practice. So we've done it twice so far. So I was part of the committee of London Business School that prepared our initial report 10 years ago. And of course, as academics, we sat down and we said, okay, how do we measure our impact? And we put things down, things like how many A-class publications have our faculty had? You know, lots of them. Look at that. Or number of sites, as Leo and Caroline mentioned. You know, we have, well, not only do we have A-class publications, but they've been cited a lot, which means people have read it. And then we went a little bit creative and we said, by the way, we also have people who publish books, and a measure of impact will be how many books they sold. So we have here a book by Linda Gradon, The 100 Year Life, that sold more than 2 million copies. That certainly is impact. Articles of ours that were featured in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and things like that. So we prepared this list, we sent it to the UK government, and they came back and they said, this is all rubbish. These are not measures of impact. These are all measures of dissemination. The fact that 2 million people read your book doesn't mean you have necessarily had an impact. They may have read it and done nothing with it. The fact that you were mentioned in the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journals and so on, okay, that may be an indication of the quality of your research or the interesting part of your research, but that doesn't mean its impact. So we got really alarmed that the UK government thought that the way we were measuring impact was rubbish, and we asked them, you know, how should we measure impact then? And they told us, they said, can you show to us what do people do with your research? Show us an example where your wonderful ideas that you publish in the A-class journals have been used by other people. And they gave us several examples of what we could do. Of course, typical arrogant academics, who ignore that. And out came the rankings of impact in the UK. And even though London Business School was ranked number one in terms of the quality of its research, we were ranked number 50 in terms of the impact of our research, which I don't have to tell you came as a big surprise to us. How could we end up number 50 or something like that? So we learned our lesson. And 5 years later, when they asked us to do the exercise again, we thought before we do write our report, we better go and benchmark the schools that got rated really highly the first time around. You know, there were schools that we did not think even belonged in our league in terms of quality that got really high rankings from the UK government in terms of impact. So I thought, okay, what did these guys do to get such a high ranking? So I'll give you a few examples of what we found. There was a school, a research where the academic not only published his research in top academic journals, but actually was sitting on a government panel that was developing nudge policies for the UK government to nudge the UK citizens in certain decisions. So this guy not only published his research, but he was working with the UK government and so on to develop policies to nudge people. There was another guy who not only in another school, not only developed the paper and so on, but then testified in the House of Parliament here in the UK, and some new laws were developed based on the research findings of his. There was an academic who interestingly did a very good paper that got published in Management Science on the supply chain of Zara. And how is it that Zara is able to, you know, stock the shelves in its shops with new items every 2 weeks when most retail shops take 3 months, who actually went to Africa and work with two governments in Africa to help them change the supply chain and the distribution of their drugs to all the villages in their country, because they found that even though they had all the medicine and drugs centrally located in the capital of the country, let's say, they had a lot of difficulty distributing it on time and efficiently to all the villages in Africa. So this guy went to Africa and worked with these UK governments to develop their distribution of drugs and medicine all over the country so that they will reach people in remote villages on time and so on. And then the ideas came from his publication. There was another academic that, you know, was sitting on advisory bodies that led to new retirement policies in Japan. There was somebody who said, well, I've developed these diagnostic tools that measure impact investing, and these tools are now being used by these non-governmental bodies to measure impact investment by companies and so on. So what is my point there, guys? I mean, I could go on here, but really my key point is that as academics, we tend to measure our research in a certain way, the traditional way, in terms of number of publications, number of sites, number of mentions in top journalistic outlets like the FT or Wall Street Journal and so on. We measure it like that. But in reality, what other people out there really want to know is not how popular or how high quality our research is. They want to know, is anybody using your research? Show me examples of your research, your ideas being applied either by the government or by a company or, you know, by anybody else, really, to improve whatever they are doing. So that was the first lesson we learned from this exercise, that, you know, the way we measure impact is different from the way other non-academics do. And they emphasize on, show me what people are doing with your ideas. Don't tell me the quality of your ideas. Don't tell me how you have influenced so many other academics. Tell me how real people out there are using your ideas. The second thing we learned was that the type of research really that had the maximum impact was never the A-class publications. It was the collection of A-class publications into something useful. And what do I mean by that? You know, when we publish an A-class publication, it's really relevant, it's fantastic and so on, but the idea in an A-class publication is too narrow for the world out there to actually get excited about. I sometimes compare it with a brick in a wall. It's a brick that you can use to build a wall, but to build a wall, you need many, many bricks. And what these people had, in my opinion, that had the maximum impact, they were the people that had the A-class publications, but then they took the time to reflect on all several A-class publications of theirs and put them all together along with the A-class publications of other people to develop a useful theory, a useful tool, something beyond just the A-class publication. And this is a tricky part because as academics, we focus on producing the A-class publications. And, you know, what we're looking for really for the papers that develop the impact are the ones that take many of these little ideas and put them together to form something much, much bigger, which I'm not sure we as academics are the best people to do that. There's a translation process here that happens that goes beyond the A-class publications to something bigger. And we need to either engage in this translation process to make our work impactful, or we need to hire people who are able to do this on our behalf to translate our research, in other words, from academic publications to something useful. So the second thing, therefore, was what kind of research really had the impact different from A-class publications. The third and final thing I'm going to say is, how did these people maximize the impact of their work? And it was never through publications. It wasn't like I published this book, 2 million people read it, I had an impact. No, they actually work with other people to help them implement their ideas in real organizations. For example, they built linkages with industry associations. They will build that linkage with an industry association so that they will go and influence the industry association to then influence the companies in that industry association. They develop linkages and connections with think tanks. You know, here in the UK, we have a variety of think tanks that develop recommendations for the parliament, for government, and so on. So they influence the think tanks to then influence the government or the parliament. They develop relationships with journalists so that the journalists themselves will pick up their ideas and you know, go out and spread them. They started using influencers, the way we on social media, to spread the word and hopefully get other people. They went to prominent forums like the World Economic Forum and things like that. They use PR agents. And if you think of these tactics and strategies, for us academics, they're probably anathema. You know, the idea that I'm going to use a PR agent to spread the, my research. It's like, really, really? I am an academic. I do pure research here, and people, did you mean wall between? I meant the wall. So, I mean, the tactics that people use may be, you know, counterintuitive for us academics, but we need to use them at the end of the day. So if I were to summarize my 3 points, guys, very, very simple. How do we measure the impact of our research? You know, there are the way, academic way, and then there is the way other people measure it. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but if we really want to have an impact on the other people, maybe we should take their opinion into consideration as to how they measure impact. And it's not by the quality of the ideas, it's by primarily who is doing something with your ideas. So how do you measure impact? Secondly is, what kind of ideas really have an impact? It's never just a publication, even if it's a ASQ or an AMJ or an AMR, top class journals and so on. It's taking a variety of publications and putting them all together to form something useful that a practicing manager, a government official will relate to and say, I found that useful. So it's not managerial relevance that we should be aiming for, it's managerial usefulness. And third, how do we spread the impact of our research? It's usually not through publications, but it's through other means like linkages with industry associations, linkages with think tanks, using influencers and things like that. And with that, thank you very much, and I hope you found that useful.
Thank you, Costas. You generated a lot of questions. So we'll let Andrew talk and then we'll get to the questions. But thank you. Okay, Andrew, go ahead, please.
Right. Thank you very much, Costas. There's an awful lot that you've said there that I could feed off, and which I will. I think one of the very strong points you made early on, which is crucial, I think, is that dissemination is not impact. A lot of people, when they had started to assume they wanted to have an influence beyond academia, they thought the route to influence was through dissemination. But of course, dissemination is only the very starting point of this whole process. And so anyway, I've got two. And the other thing I think point you made very strongly was the difference between outputs and outcomes. We as academics or scholars are encouraged all the time to produce outputs, i.e. to write articles and books. But of course, many other people are not just interested in outputs, they're interested in outcomes, i.e. our capacity to influence society. So, and I don't think these things are necessarily exclusive. I do think, to me, the ideal scholar should be capable of producing both outputs and outcomes so that they have an impact. They have a dual impact. They have an impact on the scientific community to some degree or other, and an impact on society to some degree or other. So that's my aspiration. And indeed, I call this research double hurdle research, but because it involves a double challenge. And of course, not everybody is prepared for that or would want to do that. But nevertheless, it's important that some proportion of our community are both capable of double hurdle research and actually commit themselves with others to achieve results in that kind of research. So that's my starting point. My two contributions, I suppose, are first of all to say that the issues we're talking about here have been directly picked up by the British government. Britain is basically a public sector higher education system. There's only one private university in Britain, which nobody has ever heard of. It's called the University of Buckingham. Everybody else is in the public sector. And because of that, huge amounts of money is going from the government purse into the universities all the time, has done forever, you might say. And of course, increasingly, the government wanted some return for all those in that investment. And this pressure started in the 1980s, in the Thatcher era, when basically she tried to subject the universities to two things. First of all, accountability. What are you doing with the money? And secondly, with delivery of outcomes. And through this process, she encouraged a national system of reviewing research performance, which people describe over here now as the Research Excellence Framework, the REF. And in that process, in fact, for the first time in 2014, the government introduced for the first time so-called impact case studies. And these impact case studies directly address the issue that this panel is interested in, i.e. how do you assess the extent to which academics are having an impact beyond academia? And there was some experiment about how to do this, but the process of developing these case studies has become more sophisticated over time. But basically, it's had a fundamental impact, I think, on people's behavior. In other words, the government changed the rules of the game here in insisting that some proportion of the academic world was concerned with the impact they had on society. And that was done by displaying these impact case studies, which were evaluated, and funding was allocated to universities, not just on the basis of how the quality of the academic outputs they produced, i.e. what were their books and articles like, but also on the basis of what kind of impact they had on society, as demonstrated through these case studies. So this was had a fundamental impact, I think, on British academia, for the positive. I would suggest some people think this has also had a negative influence, i.e., it encouraged people to stop doing what's called blue sky research, and to encourage people to do too much short term oriented research. So this was one of the criticisms of this method, and there may be something in that criticism, but there's also lots of evidence about the enormous impact this has had on encouraging younger scholars that we've just been hearing from the first two speakers, who were talking about their desire to put much greater commitment into influencing society rather than just influencing one's colleagues. So this, I think, Britain has been one of the few societies which has intervened at a national level to change the rules of the game. And I think, as I say, largely for the good, and the mechanism they use with these impact case studies. So if you wanted to look up it's called the Research Excellence Framework, the REF, what an impact case study is, and also to look at what are successful impact case studies, how are they written, then I think you can quite easily get that information on the public record by going into the databases concerned with the Research Excellence Framework in the UK. So that's my first observation. This is a big issue. It's been tackled in Britain by direct intervention by the government. It's had a big impact on changing people's behaviour, and the evidence there is in these impact case studies, and also the effect it's having on changing the reward system. E.g., an A class article, let's say, in the which was also, of course, assessed how were people producing high quality research. So an A class article, let's say, in the Strategic Management Journal, since we're talking about strategy scholars here, might produce in the way of, say, £10,000 or so for that department. But producing an impact case study would produce 10 times that, a four-star impact case study. So in other words, the government is translating these virtues into direct rewards and recognition for the universities. And those who do well on the impact game, as it were, receive disproportionately high financial benefits for that. And as Chris Costas was saying a moment ago, the departments which didn't recognize this very quickly found out that they were being punished for not knowing how to play this particular game. So that's a sort of macro level issue, but it's important, I think, perhaps to, in the UK context, to mention that. The other observations I have are much more localized, and it's really about the, what do we know about people having an impact as individual scholars? One of the things I'd like to suggest is that a fundamental factor in the production of these high impact case studies is that the way the research is framed. Now, the very starting point of the research, how that research is framed and who is in the research framing process, is a crucial contributor to the production of high impact case studies. And it seems to me we are in the We're in the pattern recognition business. I've always seen myself as an empirical scholar, so we're in the pattern recognition business, and this requires that work is theoretically informed. It also requires that it's methodologically appropriate. But the crucial starting point to me about research is not theory or method, it's how the problem is framed. And I'm suggesting here that one way that a problem is framed is through the phenomenon under study. And some colleagues and I are writing at the moment about what's called phenomenon-driven research, as distinct from theory-driven or method-driven research. And what we've found is that phenomenon-driven research is a great mechanism for leading people into kind of research processes which are more likely to impact or produce work which has an impact on society. So phenomenon-driven research, I see it as a great enabler of the kind of work we're talking about here. And if you ask me, what do I mean by a phenomenal piece of research, I'll give you two questions that I pursued in my own research. An example would be, what's the difference between a high performing company and a lesser performing company in the same economic context, in the same success sector, who consistently outperforms the others? Another sort of phenomenon-driven question would be about pace of change. Why is it that that certain organizations who facing the same content area of change are consistently able to deliver change much more rapidly than others? Now, those are two essentially phenomenon-driven questions. They're not driven by a method. They're not driven by a theory. They're driven by an interest in a phenomenon which is of great significance to society or to certain elements of society. And the suggestion is, if research is led by such phenomena, it immediately leads you into the potential to tackle problems which are of mutual interest between the individual researcher and society, a mutual interest between the co-producers of knowledge. And the people who are interested in this kind of work that I'm trying to suggest here or describe here are basically interested in the co-production of knowledge and how to do that. And certainly, if you look at these high impact case studies that I was mentioning earlier, one of the characteristics that these high impact case studies have is that they are often driven by big phenomena in society, which are of mutual interest and concern, both to academia and to people beyond academia, which attract partnerships between those people. So the research is driven by a partnership. They tend to attract actually in academia, scholars who research in research teams, because one of the things about research teams is that they stick together for a while. Because they stick together for a while, they not only develop strong relationships together in the academic world, they often develop strong relationships together in the business world. So this kind of phenomenon-driven research, which leads to high impact, is often also associated with research teams in academia and not just with research individuals. So that's another key characteristic, as it were, we found in the communities where this high impact research has emerged. So I'll leave my case there. Happy to follow up and answer and respond to any questions if indeed you would like me to do that at some point.
Thank you. Okay, so we have quite a few questions to address. Let me maybe start. So Murat, if you are still here, can you like unmute yourself and ask your questions to Leo and Caroline? Is Murat still there or there wasn't? I don't know. Okay, so maybe I can ask. So start maybe more with like a practical question. So Leo and Caroline, like when you contacted firms or organizations in general, started working with them, is there things that you noticed that's better to avoid, or basically mistakes that we should not that we could avoid learning from your experience?
I can take a stab at this first. I mean, I don't know if I'm the person to answer this because my success rate is incredibly low. And so I don't know if that's normal, but the number of failed relationships that I have is enormous. I have been advised by mentors of mine to try to find unthreatening questions to begin. So try not to go in asking if I could do an impact evaluation of their program, but rather ask them what their goals are and whether research can help. I've also been advised to perhaps begin with just accessing some data and providing something useful, some useful descriptive statistics for the organization before launching into a full research program. But I'm curious to hear Leo, because I think his success rate is probably better than mine.
I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, like, there's a, you know, we end up talking, or like people see the ones that are successful, but like there are so many unsuccessful stories that are not told that in itself would be an interesting report to make, right? So yeah, I think at least on my end, what I try to do is once I am in discussion with an organization and I see the potential for a project that will have like an academic deliverable and also practitioner deliverable for them, is trying to communicate that, so, okay, if you allow me access, I will use this for research. I will, of course, as a researcher, work without any cost, and I can deliver you a final report that will also inform your practice. So I try to be transparent as I can be and show that there are like an incentive alignment. And usually I try to start with two questions, very like plain and straight, once they are interested in analyzing their impact. The first is, well, there is a lot of work involved in doing an impact evaluation. Are you really committed to do that? And if they say yes, then the second question is like, we can have this huge work to find or to design and implement an impact evaluation, and you might end up finding that you have no impact. So how does the organization deal with that? And as long as the answer for both questions are a credible yes, I move forward. If I see any sign that, oh, maybe, or let's see, then it's, to me, is already a red flag. And many organizations that you start, I think the failure cases that Caroline was describing are organizations that start very excited, but when they see that like they work, or when they see that they might find that they have no impact, they back off. And this happens, you know, that's part of life. And you have to move forward.
So there is maybe a bit of a numbers game. So Jay, you said you wanted to comment on it briefly.
Thanks, Florence. So just by way of introduction, Jay Habegger, I'm now a PhD student at the University of Maryland. But prior to that, in a prior life, CEO of venture-backed companies for 20 years. So I can comment on this question from the other side. Two pieces of advice. The first one is that middle and smaller sized companies are going to be easier to work with, and I'll come to why in a minute. Larger companies, obviously, you have the bureaucracy and nobody's empowered to work with academics just in their normal day jobs. For the middle and smaller sized company, I don't see people doing this very often, but my experience was the only way it ever worked is you go right to the CEO, go as high in the organization as you possibly can right from the get-go. Middle management and lower is going to be a sort of a long way to nowhere. So, and if you can find a CEO that's kind of academically inclined, as I was, you actually may get some pretty decent responses, but I do think you got to go right to the top right away.
Thank you. Okay, so we had questions from Costas and Andrew, so a little bit like philosophical questions. So, is there a risk that we're losing some academic freedom when the government or other institutions are measuring our impact? So could you comment on this? And also, it goes a little bit into basic versus applied research. Are we thinking of ourselves just doing applied research that should have a direct use? Or are we thinking maybe we still, you know, aim at doing basic research?
Shall I go, Andrew?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. The argument about basic research per supplied. I really don't see the dichotomy there. What I'm saying is that we continue to do basic research, publishing the A journals like always. But then what I'm saying is that simply publishing in the A journals produces a lot of very interesting and relevant research, but that research is not necessarily useful for the end customer, however you define the end customer, whether the end customer is government, companies, executives, or whatever. It's relevant, it's interesting, but then it requires a translation process to take that relevant research and make it interesting and useful for the end consumer. And the way I've done it in my books, for example, how did I write all my HBR articles, is really to take some of the lessons from my A-class publications, combine them with some of the lessons from other people's A-class publications, because it's silly to think that on your own, you're going to discover everything. And it's only your research that needs to be combined into something useful. So be open to the idea of taking your A-class publications, other people's A-class publications, combining the ideas and converting them into something that can be published in HBR or a managerial book that a company executives can read. Executives are not going to read your AMJ or your SMJ. They're not going to read it because look at our articles. They are focused on a very specific topic, which is too narrow for a managerial audience. And the focus of our articles is primarily on methodology and data and convincing the reviewers and our academic colleagues that we've undertaken the research in a rigorous way so that whatever finding we have, they can believe in. But that finding is too small and too narrow for a non-academic audience. So that implies taking, again, the findings from our basic research with the findings of other people's basic research, combining them and converting them into something useful for managers. So I don't differentiate between basic versus applied research. I think both we can do both of it. And Andrew, maybe I'll let you answer the other question about academic freedom.
Well, to me, we are citizens and scholars. We are not one or the other. We are both citizens of a society and scholars of a society. And then there is a mutuality there. And in the same way, I'm not a believer in dichotomies. The complexities of life are always dealt with through dualities of doing two things together rather than trying one or the other. So I'm a great believer, therefore, in trying to combine basic and applied research to do scholarly work of significance while engaging with the outside world and trying to influence that outside world. Now, this can't be done by individuals on their own. You need a support mechanism for doing this. And I was suggesting earlier that one of the things that I've always worked in groups. I've never worked on my own, although I've published things on my own. I've always worked in teams.
Yeah.
And one of the most productive things I think about the British academia, even business schools over here, is that there's the encouragement of people to work in teams or in research centres or in research units. And it's of huge value for younger scholars to attach themselves to those units because not only have they got the experience of other people, but they also have the networks that those other people bring with them. Yeah. And it's through those networks that you get the chance to get the access into big organizations or small and medium-sized organizations, as one of our colleagues was saying in a moment ago, which sometimes might be easier to get access to. So I think looking for support mechanisms, taking risks, but working with other people to do the kind of demanding work we're talking about, it seems to me is all to be encouraged.
Yeah. Can I comment on this academic freedom idea as well, please? Because, Nicholas, if I'm reading out your statement here, which is allowing those outside academia to define impact seems like it could become an unintentional way of helping undermine academic freedom. Now, you can rephrase that and say, allowing those outside the company, like customers, to define what products that company delivers will undermine the freedom of that company. Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Because what's wrong with, you know, the society or the government out there imposing some constraint on us and say, look, guys, you know, it's not a free for all. You are academics, but it doesn't mean you can work on anything and anything you want. You can call this academic freedom, but we call it anarchy. So they are posing some kind of constraint on us, which I think actually is very useful, and it will enhance creativity on our part. You know, when the government comes and says, I'm sorry, but, you know, we would like you to tell us that your research is not only research, but it has an impact, I don't think that that undermines my freedom. It forces me to be a little bit more creative.
Yeah, certainly gives you a bigger challenge.
Yeah.
Which often demands creativity.
Yeah.
Well, Louise reminded me, I should give you time also. Do you want to like comment on each other's talks or insights, or we can also take more questions? What's your preference?
Can I comment on the question Caroline and Leon said they're getting into companies? I've worked with companies for 40 years now. I, when you start your career, you know, it's difficult and so on. So, but there are different ways of entering a company. Some are easier than others. For example, I found from experience that if I approach a company, an interesting company that I want to, I need to do a case study on, for example, executives seem to be very eager when you approach them and say, can I write a case study on you? And I'm going to use it in my school and maybe in other schools to really talk about your company. They say, yeah, of course, come on in. And that is an easy entry point, writing a case study with them and so on, because that allows you to start building relationship with specific individuals in the company, which would allow you then to do more in-depth interventions with that company that would allow you to then measure impact and things like that. So whenever you're thinking of entering and making a developing a relationship with a company, think of the easy ways to start a relationship. For example, another easy way I found is inviting an executive or a CEO from that company to come to my class and talk to my students. They love it. I mean, most people love it. And, you know, it gives them a platform to come up and, you know, show off a little bit. But that allows me to build a relationship, which then allows me to do more in-depth things with them later on. So think about your strategy in terms of developing a relationship with a company.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think relationship building is crucial, but also it is the phenomenon that you're taking to the company, as I was suggesting earlier. Some phenomena are unassailable to a company in terms of a research problem. Other phenomena are much easier to engage with them. So I think it's a question of, you're absolutely right, relationship building, otherwise you get nowhere, but also of what you present to the phenomena, what phenomena you present to the company as the area you want to work in. And again, you've got choices about that, about what the phenomena is and how you state it to the company to order increase the probabilities that they'll say yes rather than say no. And I think it's somebody else saying earlier, you want to reduce the risk by not being over demanding. But I think it's getting more and more, it has got more difficult to gain access to companies. Certainly in my career, I did my first research in the mid 1960s, a long time ago. And people were very naive, you might say, there about academia and about research access. And they were much more open, but they got their fingers burnt many times subsequently, and I've been more careful about offering access. So I think there are many factors which contribute to gaining access, and some of these ones we've just been mentioning.
If I may comment, no, it was really inspiring to hear Caroline, Costas and Andrews, you know, like, because there are so many complementarities. I love this idea of dissemination is not impact. I love the idea of writing the case studies that will demonstrate the impact, or using even the case study as a way to, you know, build the bridge with the organizations, build trust, and then enter more research-oriented way. And I think on this last point, you know, on generating fruitful connections that will lead to good research, or lead to a foot in the door, I think it's important also to mention that, as academics, we also have, two we arrive at places, at companies, at NGOs, at communities, and so on, but like with the genuine desire to learn and not to lecture, right? We have sometimes, I'm not saying we all, but like sometimes there is this academic arrogance that we think, oh, we are coming here and we're gonna like demonstrate like theories, or we're gonna use those populations or this as a way to test our theories. And many academics actually, you know, run deliver papers just running databases on their offices and never went to the field to talk to the real people, right, where the problem is. And by people, I mean like either communities, firm managers, NGO managers, public servants, so on. So I think it's really like important to build up this this humble approach on going there and learning, and the exchange can generate, I think, good ideas that are outside of the box, both scholarly and also in the practice, right? Because, I mean, there are like, we mentioned so much about the British context here, that I always think of our research a little bit in terms of the Eleanor Rigby music, right? Sometimes we do the research, it's like the sermon that nobody will hear, you know, nobody will read. So, you know, we don't want to do that. And I think the effort here is thinking about clever ways of really, really building up research that will have a positive impact scholarly and practitionally.
Thank you so much, Leo. So we're already over there. So I don't want to take everybody much more of your time, but I want to thank our four panelists, so Caroline, Leo, Costas, and Andrew. Thank you so much. You generated a lot of conversations here live, also in the chat. As we know, this will be recorded, so there might be more comments, and we hope to see you all in our next event. So again, we're going to keep talking about impact and relevance throughout the year, and of course to also see each other if possible at AOM. In Chicago. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. I also just want to thank the panelists, and thank you, Florence, for great moderation of everybody.